WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Gulf War, while the Pentagon tried to control the press and censor information, journalist Molly Moore had a front-row seat. Through the 100-hour-long ground war, she traveled with Lieutenant General Walter Boomer, the general directing the Marines' attack against Iraqi forces. The general had invited her to observe the war from the vantage point of his command post. She says she knows of no other case in which a female journalist had ever accompanied such a senior commanding general onto the battlefield. During the war, Moore was the senior military correspondent for the Washington Post. Now she's the Post's New Delhi bureau chief. In her new book, A Woman at War, Moore gives her account of the war and her experiences covering it. When she started traveling with General Boomer, the troops were sleeping under their vehicles, but the general invited her to sleep in his tent. She accepted the invitation.
One of the things I did as a female, when you anytime you went out into the field with the troops, they always wanted to give you a little special consideration, let you stay in the best tent, you know, make sure you had a cot, even if some of the men didn't have cots.
Because you were a woman or because you were a reporter?
A little bit of both, but especially because I was a woman. And I always resisted that. I said, no, I'm going to stay the same place the men do, sleep in the same kind of places, eat what they eat. I don't want any special considerations. And I always, across the board, refused to accept any special concessions because I was female. In this case, initially, I wanted to say, no, if the troops are sleeping out there under the jeeps, I have my sleeping bag, I'll sleep there too. And then a split second later, I thought, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. No reporter has ever been able to go in a battle and be at the side of the general the entire time he's fighting the war. And sort of sleeping in the tent is a little bit of a misnomer. There wasn't much sleep to be had, but I did have access all night long to his radio conversations, his conversations back to Schwarzkopf, his conversations with his commanders as the chaos was unfolding on the battlefield. It was just an extraordinary window on the ground war operation.
Give us a sense of some of the things that you learned by listening in on those conversations.
Well, I think people in the U.S. who were watching the war on TV had this view that it was a very surgical, antiseptic operation. What they saw on TV were film of missiles going through the tiny front doors of warehouses, and everything was kind of picture perfect and all the weapons worked. What I saw in the ground war was nothing like that. It was totally chaotic. There were mistakes made all over the battlefield. One of the incidents I describe in the book is a young tank commander who's on one of the very first tanks going through the Iraqi minefields. And as they get up to the edge of the minefield, there are some Marine trucks sitting on the edge of the minefield. And those trucks were going to guide them, the men in the trucks were going to guide them through the narrow lanes. One of the tanks behind this lead tank commander got itchy fingers, got scared in the situation, and fired, thinking those were enemy troops. So the young men in the first tank, their first view of war was their own men killing Marines in front of them. And there was chaos and mayhem all over the battlefield. On the second day of the war, which some of the toughest fighting occurred in the Marine sector in Kuwait, General Boomer, the senior commander, couldn't communicate with one of his top generals who was fighting some of the toughest war of the war. And he would have to relay his messages back to a rear command post, and that command post would then relay them to the general who was out on the battlefield.
Can you take us to the night before the ground war started and tell us what kinds of words the commanders had for the troops and for the officers right before the fighting?
Well, several hours before the fighting began, General Boomer called his entire headquarters staff together, and it was about 200 men and women who were at his command post, forward command post, just a few miles from the Kuwait border, and essentially gave them a very somber talk, saying he didn't know what was going to happen. It was very clear the war was probably going to start tonight, although if he wanted, President Bush could put a hold on it up until the last very minute. One of the most surprising things he told them was that essentially the ground war had already begun 2 days earlier. He already had units in Kuwait that were engaged in very tough firefights with the Iraqis. And at the time, the military was keeping that very secret from the American public. They didn't want the Iraqis to know exactly where they were going to be entering Kuwait. The mood in the camp was funeral parlor sober the night before. I talked to many of the generals and many of the troops, and many of them genuinely thought they were going to lose hundreds of young men going into the minefields and onto the battlefield. And it was one of the most tense situations I had ever witnessed anywhere, and was allowed to sit in on some of their meetings as they talked to the generals, as they talked to people out in the field. And there was just this tremendous strain etched on everyone's face. People looked 20 years older than they were. The burdens of the lives of tens of thousands of young troops on their shoulders.
I think it was one of the commanders who read part of the Henry V soliloquy right before the war.
Exactly. The commander, Brigadier General Tom Sage Droughty. He got the nickname and the call sign Sage because he was kind of much like a professor. He was looked up to and respected by both the men and the commanders. And moments before he got into his war wagon to go forward through the minefields and into the battle, he called his senior commanders together and read from them scenes out of Henry V. It was very emotional. Many of them were in tears at the time. And then he grabbed his rucksack, climbed into his armored personnel carrier, and took off for the battlefield.
You know, people in the military are trained to face death. You're a journalist, and you're not trained for that. How are you dealing with the possibility of impending death?
It's very frightening. When I got in the Chevy Blazer the morning that we took off to go into battle, Boomer's senior operations officer, Colonel Bill Steed, came up to me and said, ma'am, would you like a weapon? And I said, no, journalists are not allowed to use weapons, carry weapons in combat. And then he pulled out a little black book and said, may I have the name of your next of kin, please? And I kind of gulped and gave him my husband's name. I think one of the things that kept us all sane, the reporters who were out there covering the war, is there was so much going on, and your job was so difficult to do, not only getting the information, but writing your stories and getting them out, that at the time, we didn't have a lot of time to think about and dwell on the dangers and the risks. It was after it was all over, we kind of sat back and said, oh my God, you know, what have we just done?
Well, speaking of getting your stories out, you couldn't most of the time. Here you were risking your life to get out the story, and because of communications breakdowns, most of the time you couldn't get your story to the Washington Post.
Oh, it was the most frustrating period in my entire career as a journalist. One of the reasons that we had gone out with General Boomer is we assumed he would have good communications, that I would be able to get my stories back and get them to the Washington Post. The first night we were out on the battlefield, we ended up trapped in the middle of a minefield, surrounded by Iraqi soldiers, not knowing whether they were trying to shoot us or surrender to us. After 4 hours, they did eventually surrender and surrendered their weapons to the troops and the officers in our convoy. The second night, we got up a satellite dish, took about 5 hours to put it up, and a piece was missing. And they tried to call in helicopters. The cloud cover was too low. Helicopters couldn't get in. We couldn't get our story out. This was the biggest night of the war. I was sitting on the biggest story in the world. The Marines had surrounded Kuwait City. They were ready to liberate it. And there was just absolutely no way to get the story out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Molly Moore, and she writes for The Washington Post. Her new book, A Woman at War, is about covering the war in the Gulf for The Post. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Molly Moore is my guest. She's now the New Delhi bureau chief for The Washington Post, but her new book, A Woman at War, is about covering the Gulf War, and particularly the ground war for The Washington Post. Where exactly were you in the convoy of vehicles during the ground war?
Well, there were 11 vehicles in this convoy, and it was moving across the battlefield. General Boomer was talking to his commanders, trying to figure out where the worst battles were, where he needed to move men. I was right directly behind an armored personnel carrier that General Boomer and his chief operations officer were riding in. This was a personnel carrier outfitted with a dozen radios that allegedly would allow him to talk to his ground commanders. I was in a Chevy Blazer right behind that, and the Chevy Blazer carried the more sophisticated satellite communications that allowed him to talk to Riyadh and would have allowed, if he needed to talk to the Pentagon or Washington.
Well, you actually drove through minefields, right?
Right. They were marked with pink garbage cans.
So you could see all the mines?
you could see them just lay, in some cases, lying on top of the sand. The other thing you could see were just hundreds and hundreds of unexploded bombs that had been dropped by American bombers that hit the sand and didn't explode. And they were very dangerous, too. If you rolled over one of those, they could explode a tank.
How fast were you driving?
We were creeping. Maybe 4 miles an hour. It was a very slow, arduous process, and the drivers would stay directly in the ruts of the tank in front of them, because no matter how many tanks and vehicles had traveled the same lane, and in some cases it was thousands of vehicles, the drivers were always fearful that maybe there would be one edge of a mine that hadn't been seen or hadn't been exploded and could hit their tank and explode.
Was there basically no talking in the vehicle during that drive?
Going through the minefields was very tense. And we listened, basically we're listening to the radios, trying to listen to the directions of those who were guiding us through the minefield, who were telling the drivers where to turn and where to look out for trouble.
There was, of course, the constant fear of gas and chemical weapons. There was a policy called selective unmasking that you witnessed being used. Why don't you explain what the policy was and when it was actually put into use when you were there?
Well, it was frightening to some of the troops on the ground when there would be a gas alert and the military had all these fancy gadgets for reading whether there were gas particles in the air. And so when these machines set off a warning, everyone would scream, gas, gas, gas. That was the signal. And everyone knew it was no joke. And they put on their gas masks and their chemical suits. And then troops with dressed in their chemical gear would go out with other machines and test the air. And when it came out clear that, in fact, there was no gas, they would use one unit within a platoon or a company to what they call selective unmask. And that meant that they would ask, for instance, the men in one tank to take their mask off and basically see if they lived. And if they did, they would tell everyone else to take their mask off. So there is a scene I recount in the book in interviews with some of the young tankers who were on the first tanks going in, of a situation where their tank was ordered to unmask after one of these gas attacks during the war. And they were all terrified of taking off the mask. And finally, one of the young men did get up the courage, and he took his mask off. He started feeling all the effects of gas. He started feeling his chest constrict. His nose was running. He thought he was going to die. And then he saw a little fly buzzing around the tank and realized that, in fact, there was no gas. It was all psychological symptoms that he was feeling. But there was nothing that scared the troops out there more than the potential for gas. Every single one of them you would talk to would say, we can at least see where the bullets and artillery, see where they're coming from. We can't see where the gas is coming from.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, and that is, you know, sharing the tent with the general. On the nights that you share the tent with the general, were there awkward questions of etiquette that came up about how to behave as a woman journalist in the commander's tent?
Well, not really. There were two of them in the tent, General Boomer and his operations chief, Colonel Steed. And it was more a question of, what do you talk to these guys about who have the responsibility for 40,000 people on their shoulders and are fighting a war? My main concern was just not wanting to get in the way and in some way impeding their ability to do their job. I just wanted to be a fly on the wall watching all of this. And my biggest concern was getting in the way. So the most awkward moments for me had nothing to do with undressing or anything like that. We didn't undress. The most we did was take off a flak jacket when we could catch a few minutes sleep on a cot. For the most part, the general and the colonel were talking on their radios. They were scurrying around back and forth, trying to keep in touch with as many people as they could and keep as tight a handle as they could as what was going on the battlefield.
You think that military and intelligence reports exaggerated the military adroitness of the Iraqis. What did you see that really contradicted what you expected to see?
Well, for one thing, the minefields. They were built up to be these monstrous affairs, and the Pentagon just perpetrated the myth. And in reality, several days before the ground war began, they realized that, in fact, the minefields were not as deep or as bad as they thought. And in fact, the Iraqis had marked the minefields with barbed wire so that their own troops wouldn't end up walking through them. And the military commanders knew that the minefields weren't as terrible as advertised, but they didn't want to broadcast that. They didn't want the Iraqis to know that they knew. And I believe also a lot of it was defensive. Sort of the bigger and badder they made the Iraqi military sound, perhaps the more acceptable casualties would be if there were large numbers of them, which many of the commanders expected there to be.
General Schwarzkopf emerged the hero of the Gulf War. How did he look from your vantage point on the battlefield?
Well, there was another side to General Norman Schwarzkopf, and this is not to take anything away from his prowess as a military commander. He obviously is brilliant and did a spectacular job on that front. However, he was a tyrant to work for. He would chew out a general as though he were a lance corporal. He, one night in the middle of a Scud attack, woke up, turned on the CNN TV and saw a tape of a SLAM missile, a standoff land attack missile, which was being used for the very first time in this war, shot off of naval ships offshore. He was furious. He called the chief public affairs officer in the Joint Information Bureau in Dahran, who was down in the basement of the hotel in his chemical suit during a Scud alert, and chewed him out, told him to pack his bags and come to Riyadh the next day. And it was the intervention of General Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney that helped convince General Schwarzkopf not to fire this colonel. And the reason General Schwarzkopf was so upset is that he had wanted to use that tape in a press conference that he was going to give the next day.
What about his managing of the war?
It ended up being controversial in the end. And part of the reason was because the war moved so quickly. He had some major disagreements and at one point almost threatened to fire the commander, one of his army commanders, General Fred Franks, because he was moving too slowly. And part of the problem with the army general was that the Marines moved so quickly across the battlefield that the army had to start moving 20 hours before they were scheduled to. And it was very difficult to get these tens of thousands of men and their tanks and equipment rolling across the desert in a fashion that General Schwarzkopf considered timely enough.
During the ground war, you were basically on the front line. So you were in the position that women who were actually in the military were not allowed to be. How did they react to your being able to be there?
They were extraordinarily frustrated. Some of them were very angry. There were some women public affairs escorts that the military did not allow to escort media pools into combat because of the combat exclusion laws. And many of these pools that the women military people were not allowed to travel with had women on them. For instance, I was staying at General Boomer's Forward Command headquarters the two nights before the ground war began. I was staying in the tent with the women officers who worked there and were not being allowed to go forward into combat, again, because of the combat exclusion laws. And they were very frustrated that here comes this newspaper reporter who gets to go in and do things and go places that they're trained to do, but the laws don't allow them to do.
You were in the tent with the commander of the Marines, and he spoke in his he talked in his sleep sometimes. Did it sound like he was really troubled? I mean, what did you get from that?
Yeah, it was interesting. A few times as he would doze off to sleep, you know, he would just sound very tormented in talking, and my great fear was that I was going to have to go over up and wake this guy up, and, you know, what would I say to him?
It's just a nightmare, Commander, yeah.
Right. But fortunately, it passed within a few minutes, and I never had to do that. But it was very frightening to me the first time it happened, because I knew how much pressure these guys were under. You could just see the strain on their faces, and in talking to them, they were just so concerned about the lives of the troops out there.
Did General Boomer admit any of his doubts to you during the war?
He did. I had an extraordinary conversation with him the first night we spent in the tent, and it was just like a floodgate. He just started unleashing all these fears and concerns he'd had for weeks and weeks leading up to the ground war, and they were the kinds of things that he couldn't even discuss with some of his other commanders because he didn't want them to see that he had doubts. He didn't want, you know, the fears to multiply and spread out among the staff. Anytime he spoke to them, you know, he had to be very firm and austere and upbeat about what was going on. So I was in this unique position where finally, essentially, he could let his hair down and talk to somebody about what had been going on in his head all this time.
What were some of the doubts he told you about?
Well, at one point, he just had tremendous fears that they would lose large numbers of troops. He was very upset, despite all the rhetoric that there were no political decisions in this war and that all the decisions were made by the commanders in the field. The British Desert Rats had been assigned to the Marines very early on. But halfway through the buildup, as the war neared, the politicians in London decided, well, they didn't want the Desert Rats with the Marines. The Marines were just supposed to be the supporting attack. They wanted them with a much larger army attack out to the west. So they took them away from the Marines. And the Marines were going up against extraordinary odds facing the Iraqis that were entrenched in Kuwait and thought that they would lose thousands of men. And in the end, the Marines saw far more action than the Army did as a whole.
So the Marines' ranks were lessened at the last minute so that the British could get more of the glory?
Absolutely. And this just terrified Boomer and the other commanders. They were very worried that they just wouldn't have enough men to go in and do the job they needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Information was heavily managed and censored by the Pentagon during this war. You had, what you describe as a front row seat during the ground war. You said you applied some self-censorship because you didn't want to do anything that would put American troops at risk. What kinds of guidelines did you use to decide what not to print?
Well, I relied a lot on my 5 years' experience covering the Pentagon. And despite what the public thinks, reporters don't just automatically rush out there and put everything they know into print. There was self-censorship all over the place in Saudi Arabia. We were privy to information. We were privy to the war planning maps. Many of us knew the war plan days before the ground war actually began. We knew exactly where the troops were going to be going in. And those of us who had covered the military knew from being taken into the confidences of many of the commanders, what we should report and what we shouldn't report. It wasn't a matter of reporters out there willy-nilly putting the lives of troops at risk. Because one thing the American television viewers and newspaper readers may not have realized, we were going to be out there with the troops. So why would we report anything that would endanger our lives as well as the troops' lives? We had a very vested interest in being very careful about what we reported.
Molly Moore, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Molly Moore is the author of A Woman at War. She's now the Washington Post's New Delhi bureau chief. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.